we're co-creating a pretty interesting day, aren't we? Interesting, wonderful, challenging, surprising, annoying, energizing, exhausting. Just another day, really, right? Just like any other day, except we're doing it in what seems like a particular way. And I was thinking today about what seems extra interesting to me today about our Seishin practice. It's the way the whole thing is like one big ritual. I think at first it might appear like it's a meditation retreat with some ritual sort of glue so that we can manage to sit that much. But I don't think it really is that way. I think actually the whole thing's one giant ritual, one big complex ritual every moment of everything we do. You know, that the way we move and sit and stand and walk is all ritual, ritualized. The talking we do is ritual too. Even as we try to keep the silence when we open our mouths, it's chanting, it's the usual announcements. Even this, like this is the same stuff I say every time. What's the difference? It's all a ritual. The eating is so ritualized. Thank you, everybody, for pulling off the eating and the cooking that made the eating and the serving. So we can see that eating is a ritual. So everything is a ritual. And in fact, even the zazen, which seems like some kind of meditation at first, like something we'll do in order to calm down or see things more clearly or something, the zazen is a ritual too. Tomorrow, if you can come tomorrow morning, Chris is going to give a talk on Dogen's great essay on zazen, Fukan Zazengi. And we've all chanted that many times. So probably you noticed he says in there, zazen is not meditation. It says right in there. But the word meditation, like a lot of words, gives us the idea that something's going to result or something's going to happen. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But of course he's turning that around, helping us to see that we do things just to do them, not to get something, which is what ritual is, right? You do it just to do it. So sitting zazen, just to sit zazen. And so I think the word in there looks like an ordinary little connector word in English, just. Sit just to sit. Do zazen just to do zazen. Walk, just walk. Wash the dishes, just wash the dishes, you know. It's funny, we do expect probably the dishes to be clean again. But they're going to be dirty, right? So why do we think that there's some kind of human potential meditation something that will clean us up so we won't get dirty again? Doesn't make sense. So we sit just to sit as messy human beings, dirty and clean, clean and dirty. So it seems like we're doing a ritual today is all we're really doing, that we're not doing a meditation intensive exactly, but like maybe we're doing a just intensive. Relearning how to just do things, you know. Just do one thing after the next. Which isn't that complicated, but somehow we lose track of that basic ability to just do one thing. Just do one thing wholeheartedly and with full presence. Which can be an adjustment. We have to kind of shift gears if we're not doing it that way usually, but what a relief too, you know? What a relief. I only have to just do one thing. I was thinking this morning when I woke up so early, that a lot of things feel complicated or challenging in life, for me anyway. But this doesn't feel that way anymore. It's like, just so, it's be fine. We just do. And then the mind can go, oh, but it's so complicated where such and so it doesn't bring the this or the, you know. And on the mind can throw up all kinds of anxiety. Different Tenzos, for instance, have different plans. And Tenzo Bob Rose is always like bustling around at 5 a.m. and making coffee and being cheerful and down there, you know. Reasonably quiet, but he's got putting out some energy, you know. And I got in there at 5:30 and there was no Tenzo. So Tenzo Ben had a different plan, you know. So my mind could definitely go, uh-oh, what if something happened, you know? What if there's no food? What if Ben forgot, you know, or something? I don't know. Any thought I have is not charitable, I guess, at that point, because, of course, Ben had it all figured out and organized and didn't need to be there at 5:30 bustling around. So the mind can make it complicated, but actually, yeah, it's pretty simple. You know, we just show up and do what we do, and we have this complicated ritual to help us see that, and it's also a complicated ritual which involves intense trust, you know, and interconnection and interrelationship with each other, everyone trusting each other as best we can, and then we have those little moments when we don't quite trust each other, we bump into each other and we learn from that. So it's just being and just doing and just getting confused and just remembering. And so I forgot my Oryoki set. It's right by the door too. So I had a flash of just being annoyed with myself when I closed the back door and said, where's my Oryoki set? Oh, it's at home. I don't have time to go get it. But it always works out, you know. In this case, there's been an abandoned Oryoki set on the windowsill for like about a calendar year. So I'm like, oh, I'll use that one and then I can clean it and put it away. So it works out. So relearning this ability to just be, you know, to just be okay. To just do one thing is to just be okay. And then it's not really even about the stuff that we're doing, the activities. It's about these beings, these luminous beings in the middle of activity, shining their light on each other, receiving each other's light. Dogen says, turn the light inwardly and illuminate the self. I think really what he means, maybe it's not the best English translation, I think what he means is notice that the inward light already was illuminating the self, and it always was. We're just so good at getting in our own way, blocking our own light. So this ritual seems to be a ritual in which we remember and we see that we see our light shining through, and we feel and remember that even when we're annoyed that we forgot something or doubting somebody or whatever, even in the middle of confusion or those little moments of suffering, and then those are moments of suffering, you know, in the middle of everything, this luminous being, you know, Buddha, luminous being, awakened being. But we forget this thoroughly enough that it sounds ridiculous when someone says to us, you're a Buddha. So we don't usually go around saying that, you know, because it just confuses people, but it's true. We probably should. Edie and Seishin, in different ways, suggested a little practice that this practice period, maybe some of us will change our label for a while and we can be known by our Dharma name, so you can call me Nomon if you want instead of Tim. It's just a label, you know, but we might as well call each other Buddha. Hi Buddha, how are you? I'm good, Buddha. How could I not be good? I'm Buddha. Why do you, you know, you don't need to ask. So this ritual today seems like it's about all this stuff. Oryoki, all these Japanesey words, doans and kyokyos and inos and tantos and all this. But maybe it's actually just a reminder that every day really can be this way. Every day could be a ritual. Every day could be just doing one thing. Every day could be opening up and showing up as our luminous selves. Isn't that wonderful? You know, it's pretty great. And we have to forgive ourselves in advance that we're going to forget again. I'll forget again. Maybe you won't. Maybe you will. But luckily, we have another sesshin on the calendar, and then we'll show up and we can have the same talk again and go, all right. So there's nothing new, you know? There's nothing new here. It's the same. It's old. And our culture denigrates the old, right? You know, same old, boring. But it's the beautiful old, you know? That's our wise old selves, our old souls. And of course, the conditioned world still exists. We still need all this stuff. We need the things of the world. In our class on the poem Sandokai, the merging of difference and unity, which luckily we chanted this morning, that was handy, we're unpacking this idea that things matter, we need things, but things are so sticky and lead to suffering if we relate to them in a certain way. We were unpacking the line in there. It's the seventh line of the poem. Grasping at things is surely delusion. Grasping at things is surely delusion. The busy things of the world are here. Even when we practice sesshin and turn off our phones and try to forget about all the things that bother us out there in the bigger world, we still bring it, you know. We bring all the things of the world within us. So there's this character in the text, Chinese character that the Japanese called ji, things. Trying to keep these, learn this, you know, because all the Japanese commentators on this text make a big deal of these two characters, ji, which means things. And then the next line says, merging with sameness is still not enlightenment. So sameness there is a rendering of ji's friend, ri. Ri points to the way everything is just as it is. Someone was telling me, isn't it great the way in sesshin you remember that everything's okay? That's Ri. But the Sandokai says, well, don't. It's not a matter of just sort of kicking Ji out of the equation. We need Ji. It's not a matter of just merging with Ri. With sameness, with enlightenment, with awakening, with luminousness, with non-thingness. It's really about letting them play together, letting them intertwine in just the way that they do, without getting in the way so much. So thus, just walking, just chopping, just eating is ji and ri. Is things and non-things, is suffering and awakening, is relative and absolute. And the things are a vehicle, you know. The things are essential. That to enact this deep sesshin life, we need a lot of gear, a lot of things. Physical things, in the room, and mental things. And it's good to remember that in this way of thinking, there's no real difference between the physical things and the mental things. It's a false distinction. That we show up full of mental things, all of us. Our thoughts, our opinions, our memories, our ideas of how it's supposed to go or not. And even our identity, you know, a bunch of mental things. So we need these mental things. We need this realm of things, the realm of G. And maybe what this ritual day of sesshin helps us do is remember that we can handle and hold things, mental things and physical things, with a certain spirit, the spirit of Ri, the spirit of beyond things, the spirit of openness, the spirit of luminosity, the spirit of Buddha. And one time Norman, years and years ago, he probably forgets this now, said he got into Zen because he had this feeling like he was really clumsy and he needed to learn how to like hold things, you know, how to use his hands. It struck me like, how to use your hands? What? I'm here to get peace, man. Who cares about my hands? And it is interesting the way ritual spaces have a feeling to them, isn't it? So this is the interplay between the inner and the outer things of a ritual life. That when you come in here, there's a feeling to it. You know, people feel it, even if they don't know any of this terminology or whatever. There's a feeling to everything placed just so, you know. Someone was telling me that the other day. I came to visit a non-Buddhist meditation group that meets here, actually. I visit them once a month or so. And in the non-Buddhist meditation, sometimes like you, I do guidance and I talk during the meditation. And so I didn't do that, I just rang the bell and just we just sat for half an hour. And one of the people said, and I was saying, well, how was that? I didn't like, you know, give you any suggestions. And one of the people said, you know, when I come in here and I sit with you, I just, something happens. I feel something. You know, that's interesting. And I was thinking, even if we like studied about Soto Zen Buddhism and how it's done and, you know, read lots of books and then we like went out and bought all the right stuff and we arranged it just like it does in the book, it'd be like creating a museum. But I bet it wouldn't have the same feeling, you know. Somehow we need to practice with all this stuff. And practice with each other, our mental things and physical things, the harmony and the disharmony and the harmony returning. That's what seems to generate this feeling. So we do need to learn stuff. It's good to study, know a little about the history, the sutras, the texts. I was actually suffering a little bit on Wednesday trying to say something that made any sense about this weird Chinese poem that we chant, you know, and we'll have to try to say something, you know, we chant this poem all the time. I was trying to kind of push it into the realm of understandable things and it wasn't budging, you know. So finally, hopefully I'll just relax and we'll all just relax and appreciate it for what it is, you know. 42 lines, 5 characters each of Chinese poetry with an English translation. Talking about things and beyond things. There's like not a lot of practical psychological advice in there, you know. It's about the essence of everything. And that poem and a lot of the stories of Buddhism use the metaphor of light and dark, lightness and darkness. And I think light and dark are used a little differently than we usually use them in the West. There's overlap. But often in the West, light means good, right? Light is positive and dark means bad or evil. What a dark character. But in Buddhism, and maybe more broadly in Asia, I'm not really sure, it's a little bit different. Light means this sense of things. You know, light means distinguishing things. Mental things, physical things. Nameable things can be seen in the light, right? The light of consciousness shines on them and we can see. There's a cup and a lectern and a complex being I call Kate. Yeah, I should call it Ryushin instead. And darkness means in the absence of light, you can't see the boundaries and edges of things anymore. It's not so easy to name them and distinguish them in the dark. And that we don't have to be threatened or afraid of that. We can appreciate the deep healing value of turning off the lights, you know. Of not doing that all the time, you know, not distinguishing and categorizing things and then having preferences about them and opinions and theories and philosophies. We need all that, but we need to be able to turn it off again, too. Or maybe to appreciate that it exists and it doesn't. So that's why the Sandokai goes on about in the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, don't see it as light. We need dark and we need light. It's one seamless reality. So we learn more stuff, it casts light, that's wonderful. We try to make sense of things in our lives, in this tradition, in whatever we're trying to do. But it's also wonderful that these teachings and this practice also encourage us not to do that, to do it and to not do it, or to do it with the spirit of not doing it. Turn on the light and look around and recognize you can't see everything. It's a little like going out into the wilderness, such a wonderful thing to do. Out to beyond, you know, beyond the city lights, and standing in a meadow on a moonless night. You can only see so far, right, you know. And you know there's a lot more that you can't see. So maybe in Sesshin today we can really appreciate what we can see with our consciousness, you know, with light. I mean, we can really appreciate what we can't see, the darkness outside that circle or mixed in to that circle or something. And so the next story in the Mumonkan Koan collection is also about this, handily. We're up to case 28 out of 48. It's probably going to take me another year. Sorry, you're going to have to keep hearing about all this stuff to get through this book. But in the light, I made a vow, you know, so I have to keep going. So the main figure in this story is named the teacher. And two figures in the story. It's one of the stories of the teacher and a student having interactions, which is common. The teacher is named Long Tan, and the Japanese say Ryu Tan, and the student is named Daishan. Daishan, Japanese say Tokusan. So another level of confusion, multiple names for everybody. It may be some light, but the light's kind of like bouncing all around in these Zen stories, you know. It's like a hall of mirrors with light, you know. So it's interesting, the title of every case is four characters, and now from Sandokai, you may start to have a sense, like, what's behind these English translations that are all so different, and it's because things are hard to translate from Chinese. So and there's, like, rules, like, it's always supposed to be this many characters, and so the Chinese composers had to kind of cram in and pick four characters, you know. Maybe the idea they had for this required five or six, too bad for them, you know. Four is what you get, you know. So the four characters that are the title of this story literally mean Lung Tong, long ring. Lung Tong, the name, long, like a long time. Ring, like ringing a bell. Lung Tong, long ring. Which Robert Aiken translated as Lung Tong, renowned, far and wide. The word renowned is not in there at all, but he assumed that's what is meant. Something is heard far and wide. Other translators just look at what the story is about and ignore the Chinese and call this story Lung Tan blows out a candle, which he's going to, as you'll see. So that's interesting. Sometimes the translators don't want to bother us, you know, with the original because it's confusing and they just make something else up, you know. It's not what it says. But maybe that's what we're always doing. When we try to shine light on things that are dark and we're talking about it, we're just giving our idea, you know. Here's what I see. And we don't say, here's what I see, do we? We say, this is what is. This is true. So anyway, here's the story. Some of these stories are pretty minimalistic, as you've seen, and this one is like a long story, and the commentary has a long backstory. So this is like storytelling around the fire. Here's the story. Daishan, is the student, visited Lung Tan and questioned him sincerely far into the night. It grew late, and Lung Tan said, "Why don't you retire?" Daishan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw. but was met by darkness. It's late. And turning back, he said, "It's dark outside." So Lungtan lit a candle and handed it to Daishan. Daishan was about to take it, you know, presumably walk back to his room, when Lungtan blew it out. At this, Daishan had a sudden realization and made bows. Lungtan said, "What truth did you discern?" Daishan said, "From now on, I will not doubt the words of an old priest who is renowned everywhere under the sun." Must be where Aiken got renowned, in that line. "From now on, I will not doubt the words of an old priest who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Lungtan took the high seat before his assembly to give a talk and said, "I see a brave fellow among you monks. His fangs are like a sword tree. His mouth is like a blood bowl. Give him a blow and he won't even turn his head. Someday he will climb the highest peak and establish our way there." Then, Daishang brought out his notes on the Diamond Sutra. Brought them out before the Dharma Hall. So this must have been after the talk. So out in the courtyard in front of the Dharma Hall, he brought out his Diamond Sutra notes and held up a torch, saying, "Even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, that is like placing a hair in a vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like letting a single drop of water fall into an enormous valley." And then he burned up all his notes. Making his bows, he took his leave. It says he took his leave of his teacher, so maybe after the talk they all filed out and Daishan like sprung up and did this trick. It's not the usual thing to do, probably. You know, be kind of like if I went out to the lobby first and you came in and I was like ready to burn up my notes, you know. So that's the story. So the story itself is three parts. First, the teacher and student have a private conversation late into the night. The student's trying to understand all this stuff, right? Trying to understand the things of practice. Finally, the teacher says, "You better just go to bed, you know." He's about to step out into the dark, but it's dark out there. Teacher gives him a candle. Okay. Teacher blows out the candle. It's a great moment of clarity, of seeing in the dark, right? Literally, that's an example of seeing in the dark. And the teacher recognizes something happened and asks him about it. And he says, "Well, I won't doubt you anymore. I won't doubt the teachers anymore." Then the teacher praises him in front of the whole assembly, which is kind of wild. It'd be kind of intense if I did that, right? "Oh, gathered members of Red Cedar, I'm very happy to say that I see someone among you who will once climb the seat, you know, one day, you know." Like, who is he talking about? You know. And then they leave the talk, and the student gets out all these notes and burns them up and makes this great little speech. Okay, so that's the story. That's the case. Here's the backstory in Wu Men's comment. Before Daishan crossed the border from his native province, his mind was burning and his mouth was sputtering. Full of arrogance, he went south to exterminate the doctrine of a special transmission outside of the sutras. When he reached the road to Li Chou, he sought to buy refreshments from an old woman. He found a tea stand. The old woman looked at him and said, "Your Reverence, what sort of literature do you have in your cart?" So he must have had so many commentaries and notes that he needed an entire cart. Other times I heard the story told he had a backpack, but this says he had a cart. She looks and sees he has boxes and boxes of books or something. The old woman selling tea says, "Your Reverence, what sort of literature do you have there in your cart?" Daishan said, "Notes and commentaries on the Diamond Sutra." The old woman said, "Ah, I hear the Diamond Sutra says, past mind cannot be grasped, present mind cannot be grasped, future mind cannot be grasped. Which mind does your Reverence intend to refresh?" Daishan was dumbfounded, unable to answer. He did not expire completely under her words. However, he asked, "Is there a teacher of Zen Buddhism in the neighborhood?" That's what it says. The old woman said, "Ah, the priest Lungtan is about a half a mile from here, up the road." Doesn't say whether he still had his tea or not. And then it says, "Arriving at Lungtan's place, Daishan was utterly defeated. His earlier words certainly did not match his later ones. But Lungtan," this is Muman who collected the story, "but Lungtan disgraced himself in his compassion for his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the other, he took up muddy water and drenched him, destroying everything at once. Viewing the matter dispassionately, you can see it was all a farce." So the old commentary thought Lungtan could have been better in training Daishan. So the backstory is, behind this story is that Daishan was a well-known popular Buddhist teacher in the north part of China. And it's unclear how literally true this was, but China's divided into northern and southern kingdoms in this era. This is like the 7th, 8th century. Something like that. And the Buddhism that was predominant in the north was supposedly very scholarly and step-by-step, and you knew what to do next, you know. The had a curriculum. The Buddhism in the north had a curriculum, and the Buddhism of the south, in this trope, was more spontaneous and intuitive and, you know, Zen, right? And so Daishan was, you know, an established teacher, had Dharma transmission, all this stuff. He really loved the Diamond Sutra, which is a great text. And it's a text about emptiness. It's not a text about step by step. It's a text about understanding that nothing can be understood, you know. And he was probably a pretty good teacher, you know. It's the other idea. He wasn't just adult, you know. They heard that in the South, they weren't even studying the Diamond Sutra, you know. They weren't doing these step-by-step scholarly studies like they should, so he packed up all his stuff and figured he'd go straighten them out. In his first deep experience that there's something more to this than step-by-step and something in the darkness beyond the words, right? So he's a teacher in the light. The first teacher was this woman at the tea stand. So sadly, her name is not recorded, or any details about her life. One assumes she was probably also a student of Lungtan. And she certainly had a deep understanding that helped eager Daishan. So these stories are about a pretty patriarchal culture and system of practice. And there's a bunch of stories about men, and so we'll need to for sure study the woman teachers, but it's wonderful to honor and celebrate when a few women manage to slip through the male, you know, hegemony recorded in the old stories. So, you know, deep bows to the tea seller, whatever her name was. And then there's another story in between these two stories. So first he crosses the border with all his stuff and is like bested by the tea lady and heads up to the local monastery to see what else he can learn. But he must have, on the half mile or whatever up to the monastery, he gathered up his pride again, I guess, you know. Pride is like those toys that wobble and don't fall down. And he was thinking about the name of the teacher, which is also the name of the monastery and the mountain. Lungtan, which is pronounced Ryutan in Japanese Sino, Japanese voicing. So Ryu is the same Ryu in Kate here's name. It's the dragon. And Tan, pronounced more or less the same in both, is a pond. So he's thinking, oh, okay, I'm going to go visit the dragon in the pond. Wow, you know, okay. So when Daishan had his first interview with Lungtan, he says, according to this, I've heard of the renowned Lungtan, but I see no dragon or pond. So he's got all prideful again. And Lungtan replies, you yourself have arrived at Lungtan. You yourself have entered the dragon's pond. There's a lot of stories like this where the student comes up a little prideful and says, I don't see such a great teaching here. And the teacher just keeps his or her composure and just offers Dharma, you know. You have arrived at the dragon pond. You have arrived. You yourself are here. In other words, keep studying, you know, like keep studying, young Padawan, you know. You will realize your dragon nature. You already have it. You already are a luminous Buddha. You're suffering right now. You're hung up on things. You're only in the light, but you'll feel the darkness, and you are in the darkness. Too bad you don't get it yet, but you will. And then the main story happens. He really wants to understand this, and he keeps studying with his teacher and even convinces his teacher to have long one-on-one conversations in what might be a big monastery, we don't know. And finally, he turns to leave and says, it's dark out there. The teacher gives him a light and blows it out. So what would it be if we let our light blow out and felt the darkness a little more in this ritual day of Seishin, like these two old worthies. And if we think we are something special, all we have to do is like go to Starbucks or the woods or one of our independent coffee shops. And the wise barista, Letter Street's coffee, and the wise barista will help us understand. Somewhere in this room, there's a wise barista who will one day. But it's a great story anyway, isn't it, you know? Can we learn to listen to each other and listen to the darkness and when we get hung up on our pride, be ready to apologize, you know. Whoops, sorry. And trust that all we have to do is just be ourselves. Just step by step, day by day, moment by moment. And that's what today seems to be about. You used to listen to Car Talk on NPR? I kind of feel like I should reference Click and Clack after these talks, you know? You've wasted a perfectly good hour on Dharma Talk. Now let's continue. Thanks for being here. It's really great.